RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Jonathan Ayling is the chief executive of the Free Speech Union of New Zealand. He's with us live on RCR right now. Morning, Jonathan.
Good morning, Paul.
How do you feel after the, the little thing in the US? Is this a win for free speech, I guess, is really the question.
That is a good question. Look, it's hard to say. There's a whole lot of reasons to be interested in the American election, and unfortunately, I don't know if either one of the candidates are what you'd call a free speech candidate. None of them seem to be dedicated on the principle of the matter. That being said, I do think what we saw through COVID, what we saw in the Biden administration with collusion with Twitter and other forms of outright online censorship, that there were parallels to here in New Zealand. That is an incredible indictment on the Biden administration and what we would have expected from the Harris administration as well. So that being said, my hope is not very high, to be honest, in terms of Donald Trump's commitment to it, but perhaps what he will do isn't so much the question. He won't do some of those outrageous, explicit acts of censorship we will imagine, and that is a win, I guess.
Yeah, well, he must have had a pretty in-depth conversation with Elon Musk. It's pretty obvious what Elon Musk has done. He's kind of saved freedom of speech in a way globally.
Yeah.
So he would be well aware of the issues, Donald Trump, wouldn't he?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, all right. Okay, let's get on to matters here. First, I want to ask you about the case of Paul Burns, who was fined for protesting against abortion. What happened there, and what's the FSU's involvement in that?
In March this year, Paul Burns was arrested when at the northern end of Lambton Quay, and many of your listeners will know that's right opposite Parliament there, he was arrested as he held a sign that said $100 to anyone who can convince me that slavery is more evil than abortion. Now, you may agree with Paul's position on this, you may not. In the Free Speech Union's perspective, that's not the point. And I really hope we can ask people to step beyond the substance of these questions and say, well, I agree with him, so he should be allowed to say it, or I don't agree with him, he shouldn't be allowed to say it. If that's the level of the discussion, it's not one that's going to preserve free speech. The chairman of the Free Speech Union is a pro-choice doctor, and yet he said, no, we stand with people like this. And he was arrested because in an exchange, someone said, well, actually, abortion is not only not evil, it's a good thing in many cases. Abortion is a good thing because of climate change, the world is overpopulated, so the fewer people that are born, the better. And Paul Burns' response to this was, well, if that's the case, why don't you kill yourself? And you could argue that's a fairly provocative response.
Yeah, but it's a logical question.
It's one in line with the argument that was at play. And of course, your listeners need to keep in mind that the context is he's a pro-life advocate. You know, no one could ever characterize that he was advocating someone harming themselves or killing themselves. What he was saying was, where you're operating from there, how do you justify your existence? It wasn't even the individual, a young man, he was having the conversation with the young man. It wasn't even him who was offended by it. Someone overheard this conversation, called the coppers. The coppers came along and arrested him for this.
Wow, come on.
And we find it remarkable. When we first took on this case, to be honest, Paul, we have people approach us with cases every day of the week, and we always, you know, kind of take their narrative with a pinch of salt. And we said, well, look, send through the statement of facts from police. We'll see what the police say happened. You know, you might have been, operating in a really aggressive manner or harassing people or something. When we looked at the statement of facts, the police say that's exactly what happened. And we just thought this is unbelievable. And so, again, the point around whether slavery is more evil than abortion or not is a conversation for another time and not one that we're going to sponsor. But it's the point. Should actually people who believe this be allowed to stand in public and have conversations? And I'm not sure what kind of country we are if police really think it's their duty to defend people from being offended. That's what the charge was. And so when we got into the court system, Roderick, our chair, thought, well, at least once we get into the prosecution, they'll probably drop these charges. Police got a little bit heavy-handed, but once they're in the system, they'll go, we can't run with this. And so the first appearing in court, they said, Your Honour, and Roderick, what they're going to say, we're dropping the charges. And they said, we're actually increasing the charges. We're upping them to be public disorder, which is actually a charge and an offence that, if convicted, you could face prison time for. And so this guy was looking at possibly having 3 months in prison, and we're very pleased that we've been able to consistently fight this. This was 10 months ago, and the punishment has been the process in many ways. But we're very pleased that earlier this week we were able to see the court and the judge throw out these charges and dismiss the case.
It's kind of insane, isn't it, if it gets to this level. First of all, if you are advocating overpopulation and you're not prepared to volunteer to help, well, that kind of undermines your argument. I know it's an extreme thing. But so just say something like that because someone's secondhand, or to have this world of trouble because someone secondhand hears something, dobs them in. That's the other thing. It's a dobbing in. Don't like that in a society. And he goes, no, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, what sort of conversations? The charge was under the Summary Offences Act, Section 4B, where it says if you knowingly and intentionally in public offend someone, you commit a crime. And I say, what kind of conversation can we have in public nowadays if someone walking along behind us could get offended by it and call the cops? I mean, this sounds, and I know these sort of illustrations can fail to be unique at times, but I mean, this sounds Soviet-esque in many ways, where people are listening and everyone's careful around what they're saying. It's not the sort of country I want to live in.
Do you think the police have changed since then?
Well, look, that probably segues nicely into the second major victory that we've had this week, which is that police training has changed. Certainly we know that. The Free Speech Union about 2 months ago drew attention to what we hadn't been aware of until that point, which is out of the Christchurch mosque attack, new training was implemented for police to recognise, report and respond hate speech and hate crimes. Now, remember the level for hate speech in New Zealand, we do have a hate speech law that was put in decades ago. And the level is very, very high. The government was not successful in the previous term in lowering that bar. And we have nothing in our books that talk about hate crimes. So for police to be trained to recognize, record, and respond to hate speech and hate crimes was an outrage to us. I really think it was extrajudicial. It was unlawful. It was unconstitutional. And we kicked up quite a big stink about it. We engaged with the commissioner extensively, and we are really, really pleased that we have managed to help police see sense. They've committed to changing the training that's in place, to reviewing every decision that has been made with respect to hate speech or hate crimes, that the flags that have been included there since this training was implemented. They're going to review all those decisions to make sure they're still correct. There's going to be a new objective, a higher threshold for physical safety as what police are connected to, rather than sort of this vague, mana enhancing emotional safety type thing that gets us into a world of trouble. And so your question was, has policing changed? Unfortunately, I think we're on the wrong track at the moment across the Western world in the way that we understand free speech as the bedrock, the fundamental right on which democracy and a free society is built. So, no, I don't think policing has changed yet. I do think decisions like throwing cases out of court give them a wake-up call. I do think new training will also put us in a slightly different direction. So we're not there yet, but hopefully we're getting some good runs on the board.
Okay, because I guess you're saying it's a victory, but if police are still going to be recording as hate incidents or things that they decide involve or imply a significant risk of harm to the physical safety of any person motivated by hostility or prejudice based on a person's particular characteristics such as race, religion, sexual orientation, gender identity, disability, age, this still seems to give them significant leeway to classify normal, politically incorrect or anti-woke things such as hate speech, doesn't it?
No, it's still
perception-based, isn't it?
No, not at all. So that's the important part. It's related to actions and speech that people are taking that is threatening physical safety. And so this is where the Free Speech Union has always been very clear that things like threats and incitement to violence are not protected by free speech. They are the opposite of free speech, where Free speech is the enterprise of trying to use dialogue and reason to change people's minds. If someone's going around threatening someone or trying to bully them or incite violence against them in order to get a particular response, I think the police does they do have a role in that context. And I guess the question, it's a very fair question, of course, and I think it does raise attention. I hear where you're coming from. I guess the question is, do we expect our police to simply enforce the law as it is and yet have no broader understanding of what's happening across society? So where someone like the Christchurch shooter, do we expect them at all to be able to see that the processes hadn't been followed correctly in him acquiring a gun and that he was doing this while also expressing opinions online that could indicate he was looking at taking extreme action, you know. So where police had gone on this, I think, was way, way overboard, extremely beyond their remit. I am comfortable saying, though, that unfortunately, tragically, in our society, there are people who would look to use extreme violence to impose their worldview on others. And as they make threats and as they call for violence without doing it quite yet, I would love us to be able to identify that without them having to take extreme action that we can't ignore.
Yeah, bullying and violence is that no matter what. It doesn't matter if you've got special characteristics, if you're threatening
someone. That's a very good point. Absolutely. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and that's our general claim around hate speech, where at the moment, things like incitement to violence, well, that's you're exactly right. Why do we need to designate that as something that those of a particular racial background or ethnicity or nationality or such? Shouldn't we all be free from that? And absolutely we should.
Okay, on to Oliver Jewell. Now, he was the schoolboy whose free speech was censored, I think, in New Plymouth. Some months
That's
ago.
Correct. And this is another ongoing case where we've had some success this week. These are just some of the wins we've had this week. So it's been
some runs on the board there, Jonathan.
Quite an encouraging week, yeah. Well, Oliver Jewell, you know, we take cases to the High Court or to the Supreme Court, and we have, you know, fairly senior ministerial engagement and that kind of thing. We've got some legislation coming out shortly that the government will be passing next year on academic freedom. So the Oliver Jewell case is not one where we thought this was the biggest fight in New Zealand for free speech, but it's one that I thought really epitomised what is happening for young people when they speak out on these issues and was symbolic of the fight that they're enduring. Last year at New Plymouth Boys High School, the winner of their school speech competition spoke out in favour of co-governance. And at the Free Speech Union, we would say, if you believe in co-governance, you have the right to make that argument. Put your cards on the table. Let others make up their mind. He has absolutely every right to make a speech about co-governance. But what happened this year was when Oliver Jewell wanted to make a speech, he'd been invited into the finals as well, when he wanted to do a speech on the decline of the West, he wasn't able to do that because it would, quote, upset some students. Now, I have no doubt that a passionate and articulate defense of co-governance or a promotion of co-governance would be upsetting to some students as well. And those students need to grow up and learn to deal with it and use their reason, not their emotions, to respond. And that is exactly the sort of response that is needed when Oliver Jewell wants to make an incredibly articulate and well-reasoned case for the demise of the West. And so we have engaged extensively with the school, and the school has only deflected and gaslit. I would say, actually, we're uncomfortable with the idea of suing a school, but we have, if we wanted to, I'm not sure we will, but if we wanted to, I think we have quite a strong legal case against them in terms of the duty of care that they have to a student, and the way he has been treated is frankly an outrage. And so we've continued to try and develop a relationship where we can meet with the board, we can meet with the principal, talk through this, and just have them acknowledge that the way this has been handled is not correct. Oliver Jewell, when the issue was first evolving, went into a meeting with the deputy headmaster at New Plymouth Boys High School and somewhat connivingly decided to record the meeting.
You got to watch out for that.
Without the assistant headmaster's knowledge. And probably that's not something we would advocate for at large. It is a relatively serious thing to do. But in Oliver's defense, he seems to have been absolutely justified in foreseeing the deflection and the gaslighting.
Yeah, you've got to look after yourself in these situations. And you know that what you could be in for, and it could end up being he said, she said. When you've got
Well, that's exactly
tape.
Right. And we would have had little to go on if Oliver had come and said, this is the situation. The school said the opposite. And we said, exactly, it's he said, she said. And in this case, we said, no, it's he said, and you said it as well, actually, because we've got the transcript. And in there, some of our staff reviewed the material, and they said, it reads like something out of Animal Farm. You know, and it just indicates within our schools nowadays, there is this safetyism that I think is a corollary to what we were just discussing with police, where it's not about the freedoms and the liberties and truth being explored and knowledge being developed. It's about how can we all try and stand in a circle and sing kumbaya? How do we not upset each other? And this headmaster said, look, you could argue this is a very good speech, and I know you are an intelligent young man, and I want you to give a speech that entertains people or makes them feel good about themselves. I do not want you to give a speech that upsets anyone. And the idea that a young, articulate man who holds positions isn't allowed to challenge the worldview or perspectives of others because that might upset them is the antithesis of what our education system should be producing. Oliver has demonstrated the conviction and courage of a young man willing to stand up for what he speaks and believes in. And you don't have to agree or disagree. That's not the point. All this to say, we were very pleased earlier this week at Parliament from the podium of truth itself, or from the Beehive Theatreettes, where the Prime Minister
on your knees. Yeah.
We had a function there on Tuesday already planned. We're currently touring with a busy schedule with Professor Nigel Bigger over from Oxford University. I'm in Christchurch right now. We had a fantastic event last night. And when we were in Parliament the night before that, we were able to invite Oliver, come and give your speech ahead of Nigel Bigger's lecture. And while the school may have shut you down, I don't think there's a platform more auspicious than this location for you to make your case. And senior ministers like David Seymour were there in the crowd. I would say that's about as comprehensive a middle finger as he can give the school, I think, will pull off.
It seems that safetyism, and we'll get on to Candace Owens in just a moment, is a one-way street, though. It's safetyism for some, not all. And anything the other way is perceived as, well, what's your problem? So
That's exactly right. Others that have made that observation this year already, including our opponents, I would suggest. Earlier this year, you might remember I was at a free speech panel at Victoria University that ended up getting quite a lot of attention because the students, quote, their words, freaked out that Jonathan Ayling would be speaking at the university. And so it turned in quite a big deal. But one of the other individuals that spoke at that event was a woman by the name of Anjman Rahman, who is a Muslim advocate in New Zealand, who speaks out from what could be considered quite a progressive perspective on many of these issues. And she was there saying, if you hear ideas at a university, you need to lean into that discomfort. And what did she mean by that? She means when she says ideas from a progressive perspective that others don't like, they need to lean into that discomfort of hearing ideas that they don't like. What she doesn't mean is that when you or I want to say ideas that she finds uncomfortable, she has anything to learn. So it's not only safetyism as a one-way street. Paul, you and I are the only ones that have anything to learn left in this country. Everyone else, of course, are the right ones who have already had their thinking checked. They've been re-educated. They've got on the right plane. You and I are the ones that need to lean into that discomfort to embrace what we still have to learn. And you know what? I agree. I have an awful lot left to learn. More things that I don't know than that I do. But I would suggest that's probably the case for Anjman Rahman as well. And free speech is an enterprise in humility, acknowledging that there is so much that we don't know. And even though I may be right broadly on particular issues, who knows, I still have things I can learn in that regard. And with Oliver Jull, it's exactly the same. You know, the school only wants people to give thought-provoking lectures on one side. It was okay to be thought-provoking with co-governance, but not with the demise of the West. This sort of hypocrisy and duplicity is what undermines trust in our institutions. We see it in our media, we see it in our universities, now we see it in our schools as well. And I'm not sure if you've seen this, Paul, but the winners of the Nobel Peace Prize this year, it's a group of six academics, and a few of them worked on a book called Why Nations Fail. And the general thesis of this book is that you have good institutions in a society, the nations will succeed. You have bad institutions, the nations won't succeed. And I would suggest that the institutions of nations in the West are crumbling. And, you know, our opponents would say that's because of bad faith actors like RCR and the Free Speech Union undermining confidence in these. They're spreading their perspectives and people are losing trust. I would say it's because these institutions are not trustworthy anymore.
Yeah, and they did it to themselves.
That's right. And this emerged in my conversation, going back to that hate speech, hate crime issue with the police. This emerged in the conversation with the commissioner. He said, well, you know what, Jonathan, you might have a few good points here. We're going to look into this. But, you know, I don't think your tone has been very helpful. You know, you're going...
Oh, the tone.
And I said, commissioner, we currently have 3 cases before the courts for wrongful arrests where your officers have gone and abused the basic human rights of Kiwi citizens. You stop arresting people for expressing their opinion and then we'll check our tone. But until then, people power and 100,000 Kiwis standing together holding you to account, that is the only way any sense of transparency or accountability can occur. And I would say it is not bad faith actors like the Free Speech Union or RCR that are going around it. As you say, these institutions have struck at their own foundation. They have really sought to dig up their own cornerstones. And until we rehabilitate not our trust in them, but their trustworthiness, our nation will continue to suffer because institutions do matter.
Okay, just a couple of minutes left. Candace Owens set to visit here. We know what happened in Australia. There are pressures here to deny her entry over her views. Well, many views, I guess, but the Holocaust is probably the most prominent. What do you think is going to happen here, Jonathan?
I think it's going to be a bit of a fizz. I don't think the government will get involved at all. I think she will be allowed to enter. What I think is a more open question is whether financially it's worth her coming all the way to New Zealand now that she can't get into Australia. And so I think that is an interesting question because it means actually the free speech rights of Kiwis, and remember, freedom of speech and freedom of expression guarantee your right not only to speak but also to hear others speak, which means it's freedom of expression that is suffering when the Australian government shuts out individuals, not only because Candace Owens should speak, but Australians should be able to hear her speak. Kiwis' free speech and freedom of expression rights will suffer as a result of the Australian decision if Candace Owens decides that it's not financially viable to come here now. And so I think that would be a real shame. I'll be honest, Paul, I would think that'd be a real shame because of the precedent, not because I would like to go see Candace Owens. And remember, free speech doesn't mean you're defending the content. Let me put it this way, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on this. I was thinking the other day, she's been characterized as a controversial and inflammatory figure. I couldn't think of exactly what she said, though. I couldn't say it was this comment or this statement that has made her characterized in this way. It has been this more general vibe about her, right? And I don't think we should shut people down for vibes. And so until someone can show me the exact statements of where she has been a conspiracy theorist, I think she's asked a lot of questions. A lot of those questions have aligned her with others that I do think hold positions that I don't agree with. But this is a guilt by association thing, and I'm not sure that's how we want to run an open society.
I think in answer to that question, I would say that she doesn't fit the mold. She's an African-American woman. She's made it in the world big time. She's incredibly sharp and eloquent in the way she speaks. And she, you know, sit down, shut up. You know, she doesn't go with that, does she?
Can you imagine what would happen, though, if those on the right advocated for a progressive black woman coming into New Zealand to shut down her ideas of advocating for Māori injustice or something like that? And so again, Paul, I think Kiwis across the country are awaking to the hypocrisy. And I think across all these issues that we've discussed, it's not one issue or the other. You and I aren't connected to the substance of the questions here. We're connected to what it means for people to be treated as individuals and for everyone to get to have a say. And what we're seeing is that one side gets that, but the other doesn't. That's not free speech. That's not democracy. And I have seen this happen in other countries. It undermines our very social fabric. I think it's going to tear apart our social cohesion, and we need to continue to fight against it.
Got one quick question for you. We're right up against it. It's only a few seconds left. But if David Seymour is not keen on a swastika ban, but I guess is around with the gang patch crackdown at the same time. I mean, what do you do here? Are the two equivalent? One rule for all? Is a swastika Okay, but the gang patch.
Well there is no logical, there is no philosophical, there is no legal, there is no consistent argument to be presented for. The only explanation for this is political. And I want to be fair, I don't think the ACT Party was all that keen on the gang patch legislation. I engaged with a number of their ministers, including Nicole McKee, who's the Associate Justice Minister, or the Courts Minister, and I don't think they were particularly keen on it. They were in a coalition agreement, though, and they were bound to support this legislation. And now, when another instance of a similar thing comes along that wasn't in the coalition agreement, they don't want a bar of it. This produces inconsistency, and I understand why that is. I think we need to understand that those of us in civil society can hold these really bright lines of principle. Those in politics are in politics, and that's a dirtier game. But I don't think we have to pretend like there is anything beyond it at play. That is the reality of it. It's pure political calculation. And again, while gangs peddle in misery and crime, I don't think governments should tell us what clothes to wear. And this is the sort of scope creep that automatically we start to see this rolling in. And my real concern is with men like Christopher Luxon, who continue to indulge censorial and authoritarian tendencies because he thinks it might be a vote winner. It's a soft form of authoritarianism. And I understand that as an individual MP, he was in favour of hate speech laws. He's obviously been very happy with this extensive work that's ended up going on gang patches. If we see him starting to move on work like this more, I'm afraid Kiwis have stood up and pushed back already on issues like this, and they'll do it again.
All right, Jonathan Ayling, the Chief Executive FSU, beaming in from Christchurch this morning. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks a lot.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.